On air, can you hear us out there in Ustream land? Welcome to G'day World Live. I've managed to swallow my bread and cheese. I am sitting in the G'day World studios, as they are, and I have two guests with me today. By the way, my name's Cameron Riley. If you're tuning in for the first time, hi, thanks, welcome. I have a guest in the studio with me today, as it is. His name is Ian Cath. You might know him as Ian Cath on Twitter. And it was his birthday yesterday, and as it is St. Paddy's Day, we are drinking Guinness. So happy birthday and happy St. Patrick's Day, Mr. Cath.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Reilly. It's a fine day with a Guinness in our hands.
And if we actually had video working, you would see that he's got a lovely leprechaun on his shirt. But for some reason...
Is that what you think it is?
For some reason, when we're running Skype and Ustream, my video doesn't work, and I haven't tried to work out why yet. But if you think not having video is an issue, let me know, and we can shut it down and try and start again. But on Skype, I have with me our other guest for the first segment this evening, coming all the way from Sydney, Australia, Nick Bogard. Is that how you pronounce it, Nick?
It's Bogard, Cam, but it's been pronounced everything from Budgerigard to Bugger to Bogeyard. It could be anything.
Bogard, what the fuck, man?
I love Budgerigard.
You're like Stephen Colbert trying to pretend that you've got some class.
Yeah, well, I won't tell you it's old medieval French for beautiful goose.
Well, sorry to Ustreamer 25508. There will be no Cam's face tonight, unless, as I said, we shut this off and try and make it happen again, but... you can live without my face, I think.
Yeah, but what about mine, mate? Sorry. You
know, like, even better.
Come on.
Yeah. We're doing them a favor by not showing them your face. So let's get into the show. The first segment, on the advice of Rye, who's the crazy one, if you don't know Rye, shout out, say hi, Rye. She told me that we should have segments on the show. So I am going to try and stick to that, as poor as I am at sticking to anything in my life. And the first segment, well, we want to do a segment each week. I want to do a segment looking at the evils of religion. I call it the bad religion segment, which isn't particularly original. I want to do a segment on science. I want to do a segment on politics and how the elite are trying to pull the wool over our eyes, all my usual themes, and maybe a segment on something that I'm reading that I think you should read. But we want to start with the science segment because we've got Nick on the show. Nick and I had a great chat on the phone the other night about climate change, and Nick is a climate change denier. Aren't you, Nick?
Oh, I think that's a bit harsh. I think I'm a climate change jury's out, don't believe the hyper.
Okay, so you're not a denier, you just don't believe the hyper.
Yeah, so I'm not a denier, I just don't believe it.
So why don't you take us through what you do think is going on with climate change? Because, you know, you're a smart guy, you're well-educated, you're well-connected, you're an entrepreneur, you can string a sentence together. I thought all people who fit those categories bought into the fact that A, climate change is real, and B, that, you know, humans are a significant factor in causing global warming, climate change. Why haven't you bought into that? What's holding you back?
I think it's funny. It was something I did buy into. You know, I saw the whole inconvenient truth thing, and like a lot of things, just went, oh yeah, that seems like a lot of sense. We're chucking carbon dioxide and things up into the atmosphere, and obviously the world's getting hotter. And then I started looking at a bunch of stuff which says that's absolute rubbish. So I've got a bunch of links for you today, actually, which could be interesting. But the first thing is, if you look at some of the real data out there, you know, since 2005, the global temperature's actually given back most of the warming that's occurred since 1980. And that's actually from the University of Alabama. So there's a group of Australian New Zealand climate skeptic scientists who've got this wonderful article on their site, and I'll give you the URL. It's climateskeptics.com.au. And they're a wonderful article. It's the sun, stupid. So I'll go through a couple of those links. And if you go to something like spaceweather.com, what's really interesting is the sun's been in it's basically sat at a solar minimum for 2 years, which it hasn't done really for the last couple of hundred years when we had a mini ice age. So it's whether it's the sun, I've seen everything. I've seen global dimming. I've seen global warming. It's the sun. But really, there's nothing saying that there's no direct evidence that man-made climate change is occurring, or the Earth's really getting hotter, or the sea levels are rising. And half the scientists actually think that the sea levels will go down if the major ice sheets melt, because the Earth will get hotter and there'll be more evaporation. So it's a really interesting topic, which I don't claim to understand, but it's not what you're led to believe by the media.
Well, hold on. When you say the media, I mean the media were climate change skeptics up until about An Inconvenient Truth coming out, when all of a sudden they started to change their opinions, as were most of the major governments in the West. They were all climate change deniers until, you know, 2005, 2006. So I don't think you can put this as a media campaign. Climatologists have been arguing for this for the last 30 odd years.
Yeah, you know, that they have, but there's also a bunch of climatologists who are turning around saying that it's not actually right. I think I'm leaving Al Gore and An Inconvenient Truth till a little later on. I think there's enough evidence out there to say that the fundamental belief that us putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is causing the Earth to warm up, and when it warms up, the computer models that they predicted things like sea levels will rise, et cetera, et cetera. To actually turn around and say that's real, that's the truth, when you get people like the British High Court sending a letter out to every school in the UK after they've watched An Inconvenient Truth, saying a bunch of things that are wrong with the film. So I think what it shows us more than anything is the best way to sell anything you want is a damn good Hollywood film.
Okay, hold on. Well, first a question from the audience. James Beatty, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, James. Apologies if I've screwed it up, which no doubt I have. He asks what your actual scientific credentials are. Are you a climatologist?
I'm not a climatologist. I have no scientific credentials in this area, but I am a big reader.
Well, you know, in your defense, I'm not a climatologist either. And look, you know, the general rule of thumb with my show, James, is no, we're not all experts in everything that we talk about, and we don't have to be. I mean, we are concerned citizens, and we have an absolute responsibility, I think, as citizens to talk about this stuff and make our own assessment as to, you know, what is likely to be true and what is not based on the information that we're being fed. Nick and I are both, you know, calling upon actual climatologists' work. And Nick, I sent you a link on Twitter last night. People can see it in the link that I put up into the notes and the feed there, link to the delicious sites. There's one here called Surveyed Scientists Agree Global Warming is Real. It's a CNN story dated January 20th, 2009, so 2 months ago. And it talks about a survey that was done recently based on the opinions of 3,146 scientists. The survey was conducted by academics from the University of Illinois, and they asked a number of questions, but the two key questions were, have mean global temperatures risen compared to the pre-1800s levels? And two, has human activity been a significant factor in changing mean global temperatures? It says about 90% of the scientists agreed with the first question, has the temperature risen? And the second question, about 82% of the scientists agreed, and particularly the climatologists. They said the strongest consensus on the causes of global warming came from climatologists who are active in climate research, with 97% agreeing humans play a role. So, Nick, if 97% of surveyed climatologists agree that humans are playing a role in climate change, how can you not be on board?
Well, you know, if I take that bit of data, I'm right with you. But now I'm sitting here, I'm looking at a site which is oism.org/pproject, and I'm seeing a petition of 31,000 American scientists urging the United States governments to reject Kyoto, and any similar proposals, because there's no convincing scientific evidence that human release of, and I could go on, carbon dioxide, methane, or other greenhouse gases is causing, or will in the foreseeable future, cause catastrophic heating of the Earth's atmosphere, blah, blah, blah. So that's 31,000 American scientists, and there, how can you be a scientist, is you must have at least one proven peer-reviewed research paper out there.
Yeah. Can you put a link to that up in the chat window, man?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Because I just went to osim.org and I got a dud page.
osim.org/pproject. So my view is there's lots more evidence out there. If you simply did a Google search on for climate change and against climate change, you get all these sites anyway. But I've just thrown that into the chat room. I love the question, what type of scientists, though? Social scientists, biological scientists? I don't have an answer for that. I think it's basically, and the point is, we need to look at all the data that's out there and research this kind of stuff.
Wait. So this site that you just sent us to is a petition site.
It is.
It's not a credible science site. It's a petition site. It says this petition has been signed by over 31,000 American scientists. And how do we verify that?
I don't know how we verify that. It's a good one, Cam.
Could be 31,000 employees of BHP who signed this for free, mate. I mean... Come on, you got to do better than that.
All right, try the one I said before, climateskeptics.com.au, and have a look at those boys.
Okay, somebody says that I'm missing the point. BMN in the chat room, you know, what point am I missing here?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Yep.
I see three different debates going on at the moment. One is climate change, global warming. That's one. Second one is the whole carbon trading and the fact that people think that there needs to be some sort of new economy based around that. And the third is atmospheric pollution. A lot of people actually think that atmospheric pollution is leading to global warming. Do you, Nick, think that there is atmospheric pollution of CO2, methane, other greenhouse gases?
Yes, of course I think there's atmospheric pollution, and anybody who'd flown into any city in Asia would know that too.
But we've got, you know, sort of solid particles in the air that you can see and stuff like that, CO2 and methane you don't necessarily see.
Yeah.
But that those greenhouse gases, I'm wondering if there is a separate debate about greenhouse gas pollution and the other debate is about the effect of that pollution on the atmosphere and on the globe, warming. Two separate debates.
I think you're right. There's a bunch of separate debates. The first one is, to add something, there's a concept called global dimming, which you can go look up in Wikipedia. And global dimming talks about a gradual reduction in the amount of global direct irradiance of the Earth's surface because of the particulate matter we're putting into the atmosphere. So there was an article I read a couple of years ago, which I can't cite, so I'll just talk about it briefly, where they said that global warming is actually happening way faster than we thought, and global dimming is actually slowing it down so it doesn't look so bad. And if we did clean up the atmosphere, we'd be in way more trouble than we're in now.
Yeah, the interesting bit of information I picked up years ago was that we're sitting on about 370 parts per million of CO2 dissolved in the oceans. Mm-hmm. And when we hit 450 parts per million, crustaceans will no longer be able to grow shells. And then we're going to have a complete meltdown of the whole ecosystem in the oceans. That, to me, says there is a pollution thing going on. Whether that pollution has an effect as global change is another debate, and this is stuff that I'm sort of actively looking at and researching.
Yeah, you know, I think we ought to bring it back to one fundamental point. Although I actually hold myself as being skeptical against man-made climate change, I'm absolutely of the belief that we need to do something to stop burning fossil fuels and clean up our act and clean up the environment. I'm not saying I don't believe that, but I think the corollary of it into carbon trading forms an interesting economic article around it.
Yeah, in the chat room, Ustreamer 1893, welcome 1893, says, why be a climate change skeptic? Why not clean up the atmosphere? Can't the results only be good? Even if all these scientists are even a little bit right, it's disastrous. The point is, why not act? And I guess the answer to that is, to what degree do we act? I mean, if we believe the Tim Flannery's of the world, this is, you know, we are facing disastrous consequences, which could be an end-of-life event, at least for the human race, if not for, you know, even more species on the planet. And we hear every year that there are more and more species being wiped out, as in part as a result of the impact that we're having on the planet. And the question here isn't whether or not it's a good thing. It's the question of, to what degree of action do we take here? Do we throw every last dollar that we have at this and forsake all other economic agendas? Or, you know, do we take a more measured approach? And even you, Nick, are saying that we, you know, pollution is bad, right? Whether it's going to wipe out all life on Earth or not, it's bad either way.
Absolutely. So don't get me wrong on that. I think there's a whole message underlying the whole thing, that the scientific community has agreed 100% that man-made global warming exists, and we're causing it by burning fossil fuels, and we've got to do something about it, and hey, carbon trading's a good idea. I think the point of most global warming skeptics, especially lay people I've spoken to, is the fundamental belief and understanding that the jury's still out in the scientific community. There may be, you know, surveys of a bunch of climatologists, but there's and Wikipedia has a whole page called Lists of Scientists Opposing the Mainstream Scientific Assessment of Global Warming, and there's some really interesting names there, Cameron, if you want to go and have a look at it. Although there's also lots of people from the oil industry, of course. So I think yeah, fundamentally there's a message which seems to be hitting home with the population, that this has all been agreed by science. We actually know this is going to happen, and that's not right. I think there's another problem as well, which is the follow-on for that. And the follow-on is, obviously, we're not keeping up with our Kyoto commitments, and as we go into the next session, which is happening at the end of this year, obviously we're not going to keep up with that either. I think if the whole story unravels and we find that the Earth doesn't get worse, crustaceans don't die off, and the sea levels don't rise, and Collaroy near Sydney is not underwater, then I think you have the potential for the entire population to this massive backlash against what actually is quite a good idea, which is get rid of our reliance on fossil fuels and clean up our act.
Well, you know, and the fires in Victoria and the floods in Queensland, you don't see any correlation between those and climate change?
I think there have been fires in Victoria and floods in Queensland for an awfully long period of time. I think it's like...
Never as bad as the ones that we've just seen, though.
We've been in Australia for 200 years. Do we know how bad they were? I mean, there's Bill Bryson did his book Notes from a Big Country, and in there he notes that the only country in the world where a nuclear weapon has actually exploded by a terrorist organization was apparently Australia. So there's lots goes on in this country we don't see, because it's a big place. So I think saying, you know, yes, don't get me wrong, the bushfires were awful, and obviously our feelings go out to all the people there. And they were the worst we've seen inhabiting Australia. It's questionable as whether they're the worst that have ever happened.
And what's the measure of worst? You know, we measure it because of the number of unfortunate deaths, but the reality is that could be simply because of the way it was populated. It may not have actually been the intensity of the actual fires. So, you know, how do you measure all that sort of stuff? What is bad? You know, we've been having fires and floods in Australia forever, haven't we?
Yeah, we've been having natural disasters all over the world. In the Blue Mountains, apparently, they found pebbles from the ocean, which were taken there by the last tsunami to hit the east coast of Australia. So there's natural disasters all the time.
Well, the way that you and I started this conversation last night, Nick, is something that we both agree on, which is skepticism is healthy, right? And we should ask hard questions, and we should challenge what we're being told by the media, by governments, and by all figures of authority, really. So, you know, I think it's good that people like you are still out there shaking the trees on this and forcing us to question the assumptions that we're making based on what we're hearing in the media.
Thanks, Cameron. I appreciate it. And remember, conspiracy is not a theory, it's a crime.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Nick. Do you want to give a do you have a blog, mate?
I would do if my hard drive hadn't failed on my server today. I will do soon. It's blog.nickbojard.net, and it will be back up in the next couple of days.
Okay, and on Twitter you're just at Nick Bow, BEAU.
Correct.
Thanks, mate. Now listen, everyone, I'm gonna hang up on the call with Nick. Then I'm going to keep talking to you, and well, maybe I can just leave Nick on. Nick, you want to stick around? We're going to talk about polyamory.
No worries at all. I'll go on mute and listen.
I think Ustream is set up to listen to the Skype line, and if I hang up, it might all disappear. By the way, 15456, you're saying the fires had nothing whatsoever to do with climate change, neither did the northern floods. I know there's a lot of people in the environmental industry that would disagree with you on that, including Mara Bunn, who's the CEO of Green Cross Australia, who I've got quite a bit to do with. So, I mean, I'm not qualified to argue the data on that, but I certainly know there's a lot of people in the environmental industry who believe they're absolutely related. Anyway, thank you, Nick. Moving on to the next segment, because we've got Ian here, and I've wanted to do this show with Ian for some time. Excuse me.
Guinness.
I hope you're all having an Irish beer with us tonight. And we're, by the way, for people living in Brisbane, I bought some wicked awesome cheese and olives, including the cheese includes some truffled pecorino. I've got some Dauphinois, which is standard, and these olives that are marinated in fennel seeds from Tonini's in Spring Hill, if you're down that way. Absolutely awesome little cheese and olive selection they have there. Okay. James Beatty, I love how people read a couple of Andrew Bolt columns and think they're experts on climate. That's good. Anyway, so I want to talk to Ian about polyamory. This is a subject that I've been interested in for a couple of years. Who were those polyamorous I had on a couple of years ago?
I'm not sure what their Twitter name is, but they're traveling around the US.
Make sure you get close to the mic.
Okay. They're traveling around the US in a camper van, and they're a polyamorous couple, so they have multiple partners, and they...
It's maybe the girl, though, if I seem to recall. It was mainly her that had multiple partners.
No, I think it was both. I mean, they live a digital lifestyle, you know, so they are totally, you know, they travel, and they've got this... And anyway, you had them on your show, 18 months ago now.
Long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, and when I heard the show, this is before I'd actually physically met you, I went... This resonates with me. What is this thing called polyamory?
So why don't you define it for the folks listening in?
Okay, polyamory literally means poly, many, amory, love, many loves. It is a concept of not limiting your expression of love. Now, that is a huge concept. That is so open for discussion that you'll talk for months about it. But people get tied up on it because they start to mix it with polygamy, which is having multiple husbands, multiple wives, traditionally multiple wives, as in fundamentalist Mormonism. It's not polygamy. It is polyamory, two fundamentally different words. And they also get mixed up with the idea of swing, which is sport fucking, basically. You know, just going out and having a good shag and, you know, you take your partner with you and everybody's agreeable to it. Very different to that. This is many loves. This is where you have a concept of loving more than just one person in your life, your monogamous relationship.
Ustreamer 28568 wants to know it's what most of us did when we were 17, no?
Exactly. This is exactly what I have actually written on my post. We actually do it in the dating world. What we do is we go out and we actually trial multiple relationships. And sometimes maybe even with the consent of your partner, because, you know, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, because you actually say, listen, I'm not going to, you know, we're just hanging out together, okay, sweetheart? No worries. So everybody's shagging everybody else. It's actually polyamorous. maybe the love isn't real deep like it is when you maybe get married and start making commitments towards children, mortgages and stuff. But we actually do practice this in our teen years.
So how is it different from just fucking around?
It's the thing called love. You know, like if it's a one-night shag, it's sport sex. But if it is true affection, you really care about this person, then it starts to move into polyamory.
Yeah, somebody just mentioned 93290 Steve Pavlina. He did, and I was showing Steve Pavlina, for people who don't know him, is a blogger, very, very popular blog, who writes a lot about, you know, life management, productivity kind of stuff. And at the end of last year, he announced that his personal big challenge this year was going to be around exploring polyamory. He's married, got a couple of kids, said he'd talked about it with his wife. Oh, g'day, Nick. How are you, mate? Welcome, Nick, Karen, THT Studios. And he's been exploring that on his blog, which is interesting. He's being very open and transparent with his exploration and his wife's reaction to it, and how they've agreed that they're both going to go down this path. And so, Ian, when you started exploring this, were you in a relationship at the time, or were you like
single? I've been off and on single for many years now. When I heard the podcast that you did, Cam, I actually reflected back on my life, and
I've always wanted to change people's lives with my podcast.
You do, mate.
And if it means that people get laid more often, you know. Yeah, I mean, what more can you ask for as a podcaster?
Mate, yeah.
Apart from getting laid more often yourself, which is why we all do podcasts. to help other people get laid more often is the next best thing, right?
Thank you very much, Cameron Riley.
Sorry, keep going.
Now, what I did is I was in a situation where I reflected on my own personal life, and I realized that I actually, some people might find this uncomfortable, but I love many people. I've got mates who I love dearly. I've got women who I love dearly. And some of them have been lovers and some of them have never been lovers. And some of them are male. And if they're male, I'm afraid I don't go there because I'm not gay. I'm not homosexual. And if they're in relationships, I won't impose myself on their relationships either. But I still don't have an attitude whereby I can not love somebody just because I can't have them. I will love them. And I will love them, and if our time together, because it's not appropriate, and I'm thinking particularly here of one woman that I spent some time with, and we've known each other forever, and we hooked up, and it was just glorious for a few months, and we're still very, very, very close friends, but we can't be together because we're fundamentally flawed as far as a couple's concerned. But we can still have a very loving, affectionate relationship, and we can support each other and let it go. I mashed all that up, and I realized that when I was married, I didn't have an issue with my wife if she chose to go and have a relationship, because fundamentally her pleasure, her joy was more important to me than the fact that she was sharing it with somebody else. I actually wanted to be with that person because I cared about them. And if her pleasure involved somebody else, that was cool by me.
So you wouldn't have an issue if you were in a relationship with someone, like a normal relationship, and she was out having sex with other men 3-4 times a week, or once or twice a week. That wouldn't bother you? You wouldn't feel jealousy over that? It wouldn't bother you?
It depends on what she's doing. If she has a relationship, I'm not talking about sports sex here. I'm talking about a relationship.
James Beattie asked, were you allowed to watch or film it?
do you want the videos, buddy?
Ian will create a share folder where he'll be dropping the videos.
That's right. But believe me, the entry fee's high. No, I'm very responsible about this. I don't do jealousy. You know, jealousy is not a fundamental part of my personality.
This is one of the most interesting things about, you know, what I know about you from our discussions before. You genuinely don't feel jealousy.
No, jealousy. I can do envy, sure. I've had partners, and when they hook up with somebody else, I go, envy. It's not jealousy.
I wish it was me.
Because I would like to be with her because I've had great times with her and I'd like to do that again. Mm. But she's got somebody else. And great, go for it. Enjoy his company. But it's not jealous. I don't want to remove him from her because I feel any vindictiveness. No, nothing like that.
Jealousy is...
I celebrate the fact that she is reveling in somebody else.
Jealousy is an inherently selfish emotion, really, isn't it? It basically, if you break it down, it says, I don't want you to be doing what you're doing because it makes me feel less special or because you might leave me to be with somebody else and therefore I'll be hurt.
You're right. Jealousy is not only selfish, it is actually self-indulgent. Jealousy is all about your personal insecurities. If you feel that precious about yourself that you can't allow your partner to look sideways at somebody else, if you feel that jealousy, that green-eyed monster rise up inside you, what does that say about how you feel about yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I guess a lot of our issues revolve around feelings of low self-esteem or low self-worth, and that is one of them, right?
Yeah, that's right. Think about the classic movie stars, the stars of the stars of the 40s and the 50s. You know, they couldn't give a damn, could they? They would just relax, and they were so inherently confident that if you went off and played, they didn't give a damn. There was plenty more women, plenty more men for them. That was their attitude. The poor, suffering, whimpering fools who do chronic jealousy, you know, they're inherently insecure.
I was watching, I've been watching the television series Rome, and it struck me the other day, very similar situation, at least in the depiction in that TV show about, ancient Rome around the time of Julius Caesar, where, you know, people would take lovers and people would have wives. And, you know, actually, there's a great quote. Well, I'm not sure it's a great quote. I got a quote the other day from I think it was an ancient Greek philosopher that said, we have whores for our pleasure, mistresses for our entertainment, and wives to bear us children. I can't remember who it was. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, I've heard a similar one. It's how's it go? I want a woman who can be my wife in the lounge room, mother in the kitchen, and a whore in the bedroom.
I'm not exactly sure that's got anything to do with the quote that I mentioned, but okay. I'm trying to find that quote where I was, but I can't figure it out. But I guess the difference, Kate doesn't like that quote. I'm not sure which one, probably either of them, really.
Yeah.
It's different, though, if it's just the men. I mean, obviously, we're not talking about polyamory is not a male-oriented, polygamy in Mormon cultures used to be. This is about both partners having, an open and honest dialogue or ability to say, hey, yeah, I love multiple people.
If you dig below the surface and you look at human culture, and evolutionary psychologists and biologists are discovering all these things about the human animal, and it plays out, we think, that this behavior has been going on forever. Imagine a society that is different to what we've got. Imagine a society of 40 to 70 individuals on the plains of Africa. Everybody knows each other. Everybody is interrelated. Everybody raises the children. Everybody knows who the mothers are, but they don't necessarily know who the fathers are. Because when a woman's ovulating, she looks across the campfire and picks a mate, and one thing leads to another. And when she bears the child, the tribe raises the child. That cohesive tribal environment has great harmony within it. And the men are moving around genetically, and the women are also reaching around genetically. That, within a tribal situation, if you add this concept that we now call love, is actually quite harmonious. The problem is, with our modern society, we actually have all these rules, and most of them come from the structures that have been handed down to us over the millennia, the eons, and so many of them actually religious-based. We all know about all the religious-based stuff. But I heard recently that one of the things that evolutionary biologists, whatever, have actually been working out is, originally, societies were matriarchally based. So the women ran the show, and it all worked in harmony. And then, you know, it was exactly as I just described it before. And the men would go on raiding parties. They would go to the neighbouring tribe. And after a while, they actually realised that if they grabbed a woman from a neighbouring tribe and brought it back, she was his property, along with the possessions, the gold, the booty, whatever, that he brought with him. By having her, any children that she bore, he knew they were his children.
Her booty was the booty. That's where the term comes from. Yeah, raw bags and booty.
And so she has children. He knows they are his children, unless she has got snuck away. And then he hands his inheritance on to her, and therefore we have the evolvement of chiefdoms, of kingdoms, of the patriarchal system of power.
Well, it's more than that. I actually remember I started learning about this when I was reading Engels, Frederick Engels' writings. He put out a book, I think after Marx had died, called On Marriage. And one of the things I didn't realize until I was reading the Communist Manifesto some years ago was that in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels believed that in a true communist society there would be no such thing as pairing marriage as we think of it, because inherently they traced the origination of pairing marriage to the idea of private property. It was exactly as you say. It was to pass down the wealth of the man to the children who inherited his name, the sons who inherited his name. And that could only happen when they owned a woman. And if you look at things like dowries bride prices, which are still common today in countries like India. There's still dowries, I believe, are common. If we have anyone on the audience who grew up in India, you might be able to share that with us. But the idea of the dowry was that the family of the bride would basically, you know, create a price that they would give to the husband in order for him to take their wife as his as his breeding partner, effectively, to join the two families together.
That's right. You know, I think even, you know, bringing communities, bringing power bases together, marriage is often made about that.
Kate says, I don't believe there was a time when women had many and men had one. I don't think that's what Ian is suggesting. Everyone slept with everyone. In tribal villages, everyone slept with everyone of the same generation. You know, you just had multiple partners. And because everyone slept with everyone, you could never trace the father of any particular child, but you could trace the mother, obviously, because, you know, they come out of the mother, as I've been led to believe. I mean, I don't have any evidence to back up the children come. Actually, I do. I've been there, much to my horror. I was kidding about that, by the way.
But in actual fact, Kate, it's women have philandered, maybe not as much as men, but they do philander. Genetically, you know, they're looking at the human genome, and it's something like 10% of the human population, not for all time, currently and historically, have actually been giving Father's Day cards to people who aren't their fathers. You know, women philander profoundly, and it's very important that women do philander, just as it's important that men philander, because you need to mix the genetics up. And within small communities, that's very important, and we still have that genetics living within us today.
By the way, the quote that I was trying to remember before was from Demosthenes, a philosopher in ancient Athens, and he said, "We have prostitutes for our pleasure, concubines for our health, and wives to bear us lawful offspring." Very civilized, I think.
Very civilized.
Very civilized. Yeah. So, Kate, let us know when you get Skype installed, and we'll bring you in, and you can tell us why we're wrong. So, Ian, let's get back to your experience with polygamy. So,
polyamory.
So, you have, and forgive me, tell me if there's any area where you don't want to go here, but you currently are in.
Polyamory is a very nebulous term, and people.
I had a beer, Ian.
I'm going to get more beer in the fridge. Polyamory is a very nebulous term. It's actually a concept that resides within yourself. It is the way you feel. And I actually think that the concept of actually having a polyamorous relationship is bloody hard work. You know, imagine, you know, it's hard enough negotiating a relationship with one other person. Imagine negotiating with two, three, or more people. Fundamentally.
Hard work.
Yeah, you know, like we're all bloody hard work. But at the end of the day, it's
particularly some women I know. Not mentioning any names.
It's it's about affection. It's about love. And it's fundamentally about non-ownership and acceptance. You know, like, hey, I'm a huge fan of the whole Buddhist philosophy of acceptance, you know, and allowing people to be who they are. And if they want to go and do whatever they want to do, well, for whatever reason, and if you can't satisfy that, well, and, you know, if you love them, let them go. And, you know, basically that's all there is to it. And so, you know, I've had a few.
Why is there something frozen in our beer can?
It's called a widget, and it's the very important invention that it's part of the Guinness can.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, it's full of nitrogen. That's why you've got little bubbles in your beer instead of big bubbles like CO2.
That's great. And I'm nitrogen. Learning. I'm learning about beer here.
Yeah, the nitrogen bubbles.
So, okay, so let's get back to we're losing listeners here. I can't believe we're talking about having sex with multiple people and we're actually losing listeners. I guess that probably lots of Christians dropping off or something. So tell me about how it works for you when you have relationships with women. Do you actually when do you sit down with a woman when you meet her and go, you know what, I believe in polyamory?
It's really simple. What I do is I turn around to them and say, hey, I've got two posts on my blog. Go and read them. It's fundamentally very important you read those two posts.
At what, like first date?
Not far off. You know, like, and. It's confronting for a lot of people.
What kind of reactions do you get?
It's disagreements. But the thing is, when you actually sit down and talk about it, all people agree with the concepts that I put into these two posts. Inherently, okay, what right do I have to ask somebody to change? None. Therefore, if they want to do something, I must allow that. I can ask them to change, and if they change, that's up to them. If they feel a need to do something, and I care about them, why not celebrate that? It's really very simple for me.
But you don't have the jealousy thing.
No.
But I'm assuming that that's not necessarily true with the women that you're in relationships with. Do they have the jealousy thing?
What they feel about me is their issue. If they feel jealous about me having friends, relationships, whatever.
Would you stay monogamous for a woman because she wanted you to?
Because she wanted me to, because she wanted to control me, no.
Really?
Because
even if you wanted, you said you want her to be happy. If part of her being happy is controlling you.
Sorry, delete.
Yeah?
Yep.
Yeah?
Delete.
Sorry, doesn't work for you?
Doesn't work, no. No, and you can't control anybody, Cam.
If she wants you to be monogamous so she can be happy, you just go, sorry, that's...
Sorry, you've blown it.
You don't get this, baby. Is that what you say?
Yeah, but...
Check it out, what you're losing.
But you don't have to insist on that, because if you are adorable, I'm a one-bone dog.
Okay, so
I've got the same attitude. Yeah, you know, sweetheart, you want to go and play? Go and play. But I guarantee you, come back and tell me what he did, and if it's better than what I can do, tell me, and I'll make it better again.
Ooh, you'll lift the
bar. I'll lift the bar.
If he lifts the bar, I'll lift the bar again.
Take on all comers.
That's good. I like that.
Take on all comers. Take on all
comers. So you have a level of confidence. But it's not just about your sexual prowess. It's about your ability to satisfy and fulfill all of her needs as a woman.
Of course. And if I can't, I have my issues. We all do. I have my issues. If I can't satisfy them, I wish her well. I want to let her go, and I want her to go and...
Let her go completely?
Completely.
Or let her go to get those other needs fulfilled and then come back to you for the ones you can fulfill?
If we're in a relationship that is... based on that, hey, if she wants to go rock climbing, fair enough. Go rock climbing with Gary. You know, fine. If she wants to...
Is rock climbing a euphemism I haven't been...
It could be.
I haven't read Urban Dictionary recently enough to find out what that means.
It could be.
Somebody look that up for me, will you? A couple of quotes here in the chat room are like, Nikki's quoting Jerry Hall. My mother said it was simple to be a man, simple to keep a man. You must be a maid in the living room, a cook in the kitchen, and a whore in the bedroom. I said I'd hire the other two and take care of the bedroom bit. I like that. Didn't keep Mick Jagger though, obviously.
Hey Kate, if she doesn't understand the concept, yeah, I get that. It is a difficult concept for people to get, and it is something that actually requires a great deal of time to discuss it. And that's why when I wrote the two blog posts that I wrote right at the beginning of my blog, I was very careful how I wrote them, and they are provocative to engage conversation, and it actually does require a great deal of discussion later on.
Do you think you could have done this when you were 20?
Oh, hell no.
Do you think it's something that has come with age with
yes.
you?
Yes.
You know, I'm
an old bastard.
Well, me too. Not quite as old as you, but I'm catching up quickly. And, you know, I've been through two marriages and come to a point in my life where I don't want to own anyone or be owned by anyone. I mean, just the very concept of owning someone or being owned by someone is absolutely horrifying to me right
now. Of course, of course. But who does?
Nobody, but the norm with relationships is
the variations are, you know, he, she would be really great if only they changed fill in the box. You know, and yep. that is the subtle version of ownership. Like, what right do we have anybody to ask anybody to change? Like, we have no right.
But that's not the version of monogamy that most people abide by.
That's right. That's right. And that's why you have to actually look at where does our system of monogamy come from. Hey, you're big on the anti-Christian thing, but it's all wrapped up in that, in the discussion that we had earlier about ownership of women.
Well, no, but that it predates Christianity.
That's right.
You go back to ancient Rome, and you know. The men could do whatever they want. The men took whores and concubines and the whole thing all the time, but the women were supposed to be faithful if they were married. The women were basically owned. The wives were supposed
to
remain
faithful.
They never were, no.
No, they weren't. It was surreptitious. They were out there shagging around, and that's the 10% of the population.
But it was explicitly acceptable for the men to fuck around, but the wives were property.
Why was it okay for the men? Why did our community tolerate men shagging around, but the women not?
Because it was a patriarchal society, as we've had, you know, ever since.
More than that, the women got benefits from it, because the women got prestige by being with a powerful man who might have shagged around and had the concubines, but they had the social standing, and that enabled them to live the lifestyle they want. They went and shagged the gardener.
They took lovers, but they were supposed to keep it
so
secret.
That's right. So both of them are playing the same sexual game, but they get the benefit of having the social standing. And for women, fundamentally, that's relatively important within the whole makeup. And if you stop to think through the tribal situation whereby you've got women negotiating with other women, and, hey, just look at any female workplace, you'll notice that women are always playing some sort of power game with other women for social standing.
I remember when I was a teenager reading the Taipan books. Who wrote those?
Yeah.
James
Cavell.
Cavell. And I remember one of the concepts, even as a teenager, that I loved was in one of those books. The Chinese businessman in Hong Kong, his wife went and organized his mistress for him, and her philosophy was, well, look, men are going to take mistresses. Is it better for me to be the one who vets them, or for him to take him himself? Well, it's much better for everybody involved if I. So she basically interviewed and found his mistress for him and introduced them and set it up.
And strategically very sensible, because she could actually make sure that she finds somebody who's a bit of a mouse and isn't going to threaten her place.
Well, I remember in the book, she actually sits down and says, you know, the important thing that you understand is that I'm the first wife and all of the heirs are my children and they inherit everything and you're just a fuck toy, basically. Yep. And she sort of laid that laid the rules down at the outset. But that's not polyamory. We're supposed to be talking about polyamory.
But it's all mixed in together, because it's all human behaviour. Richard Pratt, you know Richard Pratt?
Yeah.
He owns Visi Paper.
Yeah, yeah.
He's,
and his wife is scary ugly.
Yeah, and she's had a bit of work done. But
Jeannie Pratt.
But they have a relationship that fundamentally works, and she has a place in society because she's married to him. But he has his mistress and his child to his mistress.
Yep.
And then
she knows about it, and
that's
it's all
right.
out in the open.
That's right.
A bit of a scandal in Melbourne, but yeah.
But that little social group are completely cool about it, and that has gone on forever.
Kate asks, how can you separate love from sex so easily? Good question.
Great question. And I'm going to actually put in a bit of a plug, because coming up on my podcast, and here's a podcast plug, yourstorypodcast.com. That's my little podcast where I go around and interview people about their life. I've actually got coming up in probably in 2, maybe 3 weeks' time, a podcast with a couple of swingers that I did while I was in Sydney. And we actually explore that concept of separating sex from love, because they revealed to me that within the swinging community, which is always supposed to be about sport fucking, that people actually start to get emotionally involved.
Kate, before we go any further, can you make sure you turn or mute the volume on the Ustream page, or we'll get a feedback loop that'll kill us all? Just bringing Kate into the Skype call, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, Kate Edwards.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Kate.
Have you muted Ustream?
I did just now. Thank you for telling me how to use it. I've never used Skype before, so go easy on me.
No, you're a Skype virgin. We'll be gentle.
No, I won't.
It was like a telephone.
Funny that. Ian, sorry, keep going what you were saying, then we'll bring Kate in.
What was I talking about? Oh, that's right. The guys who I interviewed in Sydney.
Yep.
They're swingers, you know, so they go out sport fucking. And
so there's no love.
It's just sex. You know, Willie actually said to me that that sometimes at the end of the session they would turn around and introduce each other. You know, they didn't even know each other's names before they had sex. But what happens is people start to find each other attractive, and then they engage, and emotion starts to evolve, and it corrupts sport sex.
I remember my shrink in Melbourne a few years ago when we were talking about polyamory, telling me that in his experience many years in doing couples therapy and talking to people about that he had found that humans are essentially monogamous, that open relationships very rarely, if ever, worked in his experience as a therapist.
Yeah, I can get that.
Yeah?
Yeah, I would probably agree with that.
So what's the difference between an open relationship and polyamory?
No, there is no real difference. You know, polyamory is an open relationship.
But you agree that it doesn't work?
I think it's very hard. I think
harder than a monogamous relationship?
I think harder than a monogamous relationship. If you have the fundamental aspect of all good relationships, doesn't matter what you want to tag them, is communication.
Yep.
Good, open, honest communication, where you're prepared to reveal your open heart. That will enable you to have a great relationship, irrelevant of what you want to tag it. You know, like, just, you know, I just talk, people. Just be prepared to reveal every little last bit of yourself to your partner. And you'll be surprised that I feel that they will generally go, cool, I really love you for that. Thank you.
Okay, Kate.
Can I have to put my hand up or something?
Yeah, go on.
Talk to us, Kate.
Maybe it makes a difference where you come into it towards an open relationship. If you start with an open relationship, generally it could continue with a much greater success rate than if you tried one, say, 2 years in. I mean, it all comes down to norms and standards that you create from the start, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right, Kate. I think if you actually came into a relationship that was quite extreme and you tried to take it to another extreme partway through, it's going to be hard work. If you wanted to modify your relationship partway through it, but you already had a very open, communicative relationship from the beginning, I think you've got a much better chance. What I'm saying in that is communication's the fundamental aspect of it. You know, mm-hmm. How many people do you know who don't communicate within their relationships? I think it's
Most of the failed ones.
Yeah, that's right. It's the pivotal part of it. You know, communicate. And if you can communicate well between two people because you love each other, well, then you can start presenting some pretty radical ideas, and maybe you can change things. But that's one reason why I got my two blog posts where I actually flagged this. You know, like, hey, go and read these two posts, and if you run away kicking and screaming, well, fair enough. Yeah, we don't even have to go any further.
Have you actually said that to someone? Go and read my blog posts.
Oh yeah, yeah. I've done it in three situations. Yeah. But, hey, you know, like, hey, this has been a really wonderful night. You know, hey, I'd really like you to go and read these blog posts.
I believe that, actually. I've had a man say that to me before.
And how was it for you?
It was really refreshing, actually, because I knew already, and it was just nice that he didn't lie to me. He walked up and said, hi, my name's this, and I'm a slut. Do you want to hang out for a bit?
Right.
That was quite literally a direct quote, and yeah. I went, oh, okay. that's your deal. I guess I'll have to deal with that for a little while.
Yeah, and what did you just say there? You know, you've got open communication, you've got acceptance, and you've got, well, let's see where it goes. Yeah, open communication is where it starts, but the next level is acceptance. And that's where what I was raving on about before is, you know, you have no choice but to accept the other person. You know, I've got friends who've got dysfunctional relationships and they complain bitterly about their partners, and I just turn around to them, shrug, and go, you have no choice but to accept them. None.
And how hard can it really be? I mean,
no, it's
all
hard because you have to accept the things that you actually don't like because you made compromises early in the relationship. And you have to then accept the fact that you screwed up, you know, 15 years ago. And a lot of people find that challenging. You know, when I broke up with my wife, I remember very clearly when we came to the end of the relationship, I went, I adore this woman and I accept her as she is. And I think she's gorgeous. But in accepting her as she is, it's time for me to move on. And this is where it goes. So it was a place of complete acceptance, and all relationships end with acceptance. Mm-hmm. We actually do everything based around acceptance. We just struggle with the concept of it.
So, Kate, what's your view on polyamory?
It's a big topic. It's hard for me to see a future in it. That's the problem. I am only 23, and as you were bringing up the age differences before, maybe later in life I don't have to think about it so much. But, I mean, if polyamory is the way to go, then it's hard to plan for the long term, isn't it? But I guess with polyamory and its very essence, I could have 5 or 6 forevers, couldn't I? Is that something that could happen?
I think part of the problem with the, you know, polyamory is only, as a term, has only been around since, I think, the mid-90s. I think a lot of people actually get a bit of a problem with polyamory is that they actually think there are rules. And there aren't. The only thing close to a rule is the fact that you should just love people. You don't have to have multiple sexual partners. What you have to have is open communication and allow people to be who they are. Really, that's all there is to it. The rest of the stuff is all of the noise that we're making around the concept of polyamory.
So, Kate, let me ask you a question. I mean, do you at 20, how old did you say you are?
23.
At 23, Kate, do you think that you could be with one man for the rest of your life, is or woman? I don't want to make assumptions here, Kate. one suicide girl, perhaps?
Oh, stop.
Is that your ideal?
Well, that's another thing, isn't it? I mean, marriage is a whole different topic to even go into. I couldn't see myself with anyone past, I don't know, 5 or something years. But I don't know. It's so hard to be able to say yes to. I mean, polyamorous, is that even a relationship? I don't understand the term. Would I be in a relationship? Would I be in 5 relationships? Because relationship to me is security, and security is something that someone. I guess it does come back to whether or not.
Do you really think there's any security in a relationship? I mean, you've seen people in relationships. Did you see a lot of security inherent in there?
Well, there can be, I guess. It's a saying yes to monogamy means that there is a level of trust. I mean, you've got to trust the person a hell of a lot more if. Well, I guess not. I mean,
60% of marriages end in divorce in this country. I mean, what does that say about monogamy?
Yeah, actually, Kate, you're right. You have to trust somebody. You know, like, okay, I've seen a few of your tweets. You're a romantic at heart. You know, you just want somebody to indulge and indulge you.
That's all it takes.
Yeah, that's right. But you actually want more than that. You want somebody special. Now, so you've got somebody, imagine you've got somebody wonderful like you've had in your past, I'm sure, in your life, and you care about them and they care about you, and it's all bubbling along and it's an open communication. You both are exchanging ideas and concepts, and then you meet somebody else and you think, you know, if this is really exciting, and you want to share that with your partner, or your partner meets somebody else and they want to share that with you. And so long as it's open and it's honest, wouldn't you revel in your partner or you sharing these things with each other?
Interestingly enough, I actually I was in that situation not too long ago. I was in an open relationship or polyamorous or whatever I can call it. And it did come about that there was another person. And the way that we got around any sort of jealousy was that I got to choose what she looked like. There was a bunch of other people. And he just went, yeah, look, you know, let's somebody else in this whole thing. And I just went, all right, as long as she's not blonde and skinnier than me, that's it. You can do whatever you want. So I guess
that's the queen actually choosing the concubines.
I think so. And that's polyamory with the security that I need. So, yeah. I mean, that's the perfect.
That's right. So you're talking about polyamory with conditions. Okay, fair enough. And if he agreed to that, that works. There are no rules.
It could be something else as well. It could be worry that the person isn't coming back.
But that is jealousy. By definition, that is jealousy. And that
it is just worry, though.
No, it's jealousy, and it's based on insecurity.
I guess it's a hard concept to let somebody go. I mean, that's not easy. If you want this person to be around all the time, all of a sudden there's a chance that they won't be. I mean, letting go is hard.
Sure. I'm not saying it's easy.
So to have the security.
But the thing is, I'll tell you this much from experience, you let them go and you do it with confidence, you're damn attractive.
And happier.
Well, within yourself. But you actually tend to win the person.
Probably. Actually, definitely. Yeah, I could definitely agree with that.
And you know, I was actually leading Cam down a particular path for a reason. When
you're manipulative. Son of a bitch.
I've been
listening. Yeah, I can see straight through that.
I've been listening to the G'day World for a long time. The reality is, when I am connected to somebody, that connection is profound. And it doesn't matter if they are with somebody else, so long as the connection is still there. And I could actually watch her engaging in an act with somebody else and be happy for her, so long as the connection's there. But if the connection is ever lost, then I am human. Then I feel sadness because then, you know, I go through the grieving process. And
yeah, that's
maybe,
the loss, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's okay. And I'm prepared to risk that because the benefits that come with being prepared to risk that are so rich because you're not susceptible to all of the shit that comes with all this Judeo-Christian mumbo-jumbo shit that we actually have within our patriarchal monogamous society.
Mm.
It's all based about love and affection and allowing people to be who they are and acceptance.
James is asking us to define the difference between envy and jealousy.
Envy is where you wish, James, to be with that person. Jealousy is where you want to take the person who is with your partner and remove them. Because you feel threatened by them. Jealousy is inherently an insecurity. Envy is a desire.
I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing at repent, blasphemer. I agree with that. Maybe jealousy has more to do with anger and envy is sadness. And it's
Envy is just, I would love to be there. Madikins flew back to London today. You know, I miss the girl, you know. Yeah, I have there is an element of envy. I would love to be in Hong Kong with her right now. You know, sure. But I'm not jealous of Hong Kong for having her.
That's the other hard thing about polyamory. Sorry,
Kate, what'd you say?
That's the other hard thing about polyamory. I mean, with so many people all the time, it's just one big, I wish I was with this person, because you can't be with everyone at once.
Yeah.
This is not a perfect world. You can't be with everyone at once.
Yeah. And I think that's where the reality of polyamory, we've been talking, there are many levels of polyamory where I actually talk more about the personal, emotional aspect of polyamory. I think a lot of people, if you actually get into the nuts and bolts of a polyamorous relationship with multiple partners, you've got a lot of timetabling and management of schedules and, you know, bloody menstrual cycles. And God, how complicated would it be to just make it work?
Yeah.
All right.
What about if you had one that you had all the time, one girl, and then as many people as you want on the side, and your let's say Fridays and Saturday nights, the special nights, were set for this one girl, so she was your main girl, but you could be with anyone you want. Is that still polyamory?
Yeah, it's still polyamory, because if that's the way you want. There are no rules to polyamory. It's what the core couple negotiate.
Oh, God, how hard would it be, though, to find someone else who thinks the exact same as you?
It could be very challenging, but people do it. There are people out there who pull this off.
And also people out there who are willing to change for the other person's particular wants and needs, which is also very good.
Yeah. Now, you said people who are prepared to change for the other person's wants and needs. I am huge on this fact. You have no right to ask somebody else to change, but you have every right to mention it to them, to suggest it, and then they can change of their own volition. They can choose to change. So you said people can choose to change to suit their partner. Sure. If you want to do that, great, go for it.
It's just an offer, I guess.
Yeah, well, you care about somebody.
I mean, in a world where people are dating multiple people, I mean, and somebody mentioned before what we did when we were 17, I mean, when you're in a situation where you're dating multiple people and you obviously, you know, you go out with someone on a couple of dates, you care about them, you're starting to develop a bond, you're starting to get an understanding of who they are, what makes them tick. I mean, that's not unusual. I mean, we all do that at different stages of our lives where we'll be dating multiple people at the same time and not necessarily committing to any of them, but, you know, developing a bond and a love for who they are. And, you know, you might get to a point where you decide, well, I only want to be with one person. But, you know, the experience of dating multiple people simultaneously and caring about all of them is quite acceptable and common. How is that any different to this? I mean,
it's not. It's not. It's just that that is deemed as immature.
We call it dating.
We call it dating. And I actually, that blog post that I've written actually talks about that. You know, we do it in our youth.
Yeah.
And that's seen as okay. But then we're supposed to grow up.
Right.
And we're supposed to stop.
Commit to one person.
That's right.
Right.
You know, and then we've got to do it the proper way. And it's called monogamy. And then you whack a ring on somebody's finger and have a ceremony and yada, 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 and it all goes to poo.
Well, we've been going for an hour and 20 now, folks. I'm going to try and wrap this up. Kate, any more questions or comments, commentary, insight from you?
No, I'm done. I'm done here. I'll have a think about it.
So where have you come, you know, at the end of this, Kate? Are you anti-polyamory or are you pro or is the jury out?
It's a concept that I support. And anyone who has the strength inside them to pull it off is, I admire them. I can't see how to take jealousy out of my mind. So I would, without a manual, I don't know how I'm going to do this, or a mentor or something. I couldn't do it, but I applaud people who can.
What when you talk about jealousy in your mind, how do you break that down? I mean, what is that emotion of jealousy to you? If somebody that you care about is with another woman, I mean, how does it actually make you feel? What goes on?
Well, it's completely irrational, and I know that it is, and that's the hardest part about it. It's not even them with somebody else. It's that they're not with me.
Yeah.
That's the issue, I think. And maybe I'm selfish. That's probably what it comes down to. But I want everyone to be happy. That's all I want. But it's a mental roadblock, I think. I wish I knew the root cause of more, but I just don't know. It's just jealousy. I don't know.
Okay.
Sorry, not to answer. I don't know. I can't answer it. Where does jealousy come from?
Do you think you're not beautiful enough? Do you think you're not special enough? Do you think that you could not be everything that they want you to be?
I think
if you can be all of those things, why would you doubt that you could not win them back?
I guess that's it. I mean, even if I know I have them and they're not even with anyone else, even the thought that they might want to be with somebody else, it's irrational. I know it is. It's completely irrational. Why wouldn't I want these people to have fun or do anything? But it's just the worry that they don't have as much in the relationship as I do, and it's one-sided, and I'm putting more in and I feel like a fool. Maybe that could be it. I mean, maybe that's one situation.
But if you knew the situation going into it, why would you feel like a fool? If the person was honest with you up front, why would you feel like a fool?
Maybe I don't know, maybe I was ignoring it. Maybe it's too easy to say yes, and it's a whole different kettle of fish to actually I do.
Easy to deal with it in theory, but not so much in practice.
Yes, exactly. I can completely understand the concept, but in practice it hurts.
Yeah. The reality is, you know, we can sprout on all night long about all this stuff and most, you know, theoretically, but to put it in practice is actually challenging. And even though I've come in on this to promote, you know, the idea, I suppose, at a level, yeah, it's hard. You know, my heart bleeds when I put somebody on a plane and send them back to London. Sure.
You know, exactly.
Yeah, we're all human.
But it's a concept worth thinking about, that's for damn sure. I mean, if you're unhappy in a monogamous relationship, there are other options out there. I mean, why does monogamy have to even stand for forever? Why can't monogamy mean a couple of months with one person, a couple of months with another? I mean, there's so much grey area that society doesn't allow for and teach. That's my main issue.
I'm going to put a bit of a plug in there. There's a podcast. I think it's a pretty bloody awesome podcast. It's called Polyamory Weekly. It's run by Minx out of, I think, Chicago. If you want to understand a bit of polyamory stuff, you know, I think it's a very good place to go and dig. And they cover all sorts of different subjects. And there are links from Minx's podcast to all sorts of places. Polyamory Weekly.
And with that, I want to thank my guests tonight, the lovely Kate Edwards. Thank you for downloading Skype and getting your head around it to come on the show, Kate.
Thank you for having me and finally forcing me to download this damn program.
And, you know, we hope that you, resolve your issues.
Yeah, look, that'd be nice. I think the whole world would be happy about that, especially Twitter followers.
I want to thank, of course, Ian Kath, who's here with me, been drinking beer with me all night, and Nick Bojard, Nick Bojard. Who was still on Skype. Hey, Nick.
Hey, I'm still here. That was so interesting, but I can't do it. I've got four kids.
Well, that's the reason why you can't do it,
man. It makes it a lot more
challenging,
mate. That's right.
No. I've got two kids.
Yes, it does.
I'm also divorced, but, you know.
Well, that's does Nick have a wife?
I do. Luckily, that's how we got the four kids.
Well, there you go. You're living the dream. I wish I could be happy like that.
And thanks to everyone who tuned in. It's great to have you all along for the ride. It's fun having an audience listening in and chatting. I really appreciate you guys taking the time and the feedback. And we'll be doing this again. Well, I'll be doing it again next Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Sydney time, 8 p.m. Brisbane time, and whatever fucking time that is in Perth. I don't know.
Can we do monkey sex next time?
Monkey sex. We're going to bring in monkeys and actually get them going at it?
Yeah, why not?
I'd pay to see that. I'll have to make sure the video's working next time.
Yeah, I'm going to need a video stream.
Monkey sex on G'day World.
You can come and watch, Kate. You can be in charge of the lube.
Oh, thank you. It's really sweet.
No, it's not. It's really messy.
That's enough.
You should see what they can do with a prehensile tail.
Oh, yeah. Ginge, I was going to do the Pope's trip to Africa, but we just ran out of time doing polyamory.
Hey, I've got to give a plug for the latest podcast I put out. It's Andrew at Trash Video, and he uses this term, and I think it's just hysterical. Is the Pope a pointy-headed kitty fiddler?
Yes, I think we agree. Yes, absolutely.
Even I'd agree with that.
I was going to talk about the fact that the Pope Benedict is going to Africa for the first time officially, and I wanted to talk about the Catholic Church's continual denial of allowing their followers to legitimately use condoms and the millions of deaths that's potentially causing as a result, mostly women. In Africa dying from HIV because the men are going out and fucking around and coming home and then fucking the women and they can't force them to use condoms. But we'll save that for next week, and I think I'll have a go at the Pope next week. And hopefully my Christian co-host, Joshua Withers, will be on the show with me next week, and we'll be able to debate that with Christian. I need a Christian co-host to sort of balance my rhetoric on that kind of stuff. So anyway, thanks again, everyone, and we're out.
Bye-bye.
Bye.